dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the aspects of that war, which we largely neglect, is the dimension that is brought to it by nuclear weapons, specifically the threats posed to us increasingly by adversaries, not just the familiar one, Russia, but China as well, and perhaps others, and what we must do to protect ourselves against such threats. One of the country's preeminent authorities on such matters, I'm very pleased to say, is our guest for the first two segments of today's program. His name is Dr. Mark Schneider. We frequently consult with him about such matters, but we are especially anxious to do so at a moment when not only are our adversaries stealing a march on us, it appears, with respect to building up extraordinarily ominous nuclear capabilities and adopting doctrines that are worrying, but our own deterrent forces are obsolescent and, unfortunately, increasingly unlikely to be effective in deterring aggression against us. Dr. Mark Schneider is a senior fellow at the highly regarded National Institute for Public Policy. I had the privilege of working with him decades ago in the Pentagon. He went on in the years that elapsed thereafter to become one of the foremost authorities within the Defense Department and, for that matter, the U.S. government on nuclear matters, policy and programs and arms control and the threat and so much more. And we're always delighted and privileged to be able to pick his brain about these very important and often overlooked issues. Mark Schneider, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Well, thank you very much for that kind introduction.
Well, it's heartfelt and deserved. Let me ask you, Mark, for starters, to talk a little bit about China. As it happens, there's a bit of a news peg. The United States sent nuclear-capable, that isn't to say they were nuclear-armed, but nuclear-capable B-52 bombers, two of them, overflying parts of the South China Sea and engaging in exercises there as a not too subtle signal, the latest, to the Chinese that we contest their increasing assertion of sovereign control over those important and increasingly strategic waters. What did you make of that, Mark? And more to the point, what do you think the Chinese made of it?
The issue here is of extreme importance. The Chinese have made a blatantly illegal claim for the entire South China Sea. There's no basis whatsoever for it in international law. They have lost in the International Court of Arbitration on it. The Philippines sued them for, in effect, seizing Philippine territory, which they've done, and also a territory claimed by other states. And they're building artificial island military bases and claiming sovereignty over an area of the ocean in which literally 40% of the world's trade passes. This is something we cannot accept, and this is something that the freedom of navigation, that's what they're called, flights of the B-52s, were about, to indicate to the Chinese as graphically as we can that we do not accept their illegal claims to a large area of the ocean.
And this really is a critical matter, Mark, in many, many dimensions, including just the old-fashioned conventional ones. But I'm interested in your thoughts. These bombers, probably 30 or 40 years old, flying over in a fairly ephemeral way, let's face it.
Well, closer to 60.
Well, it depends, I guess, on the model, but whichever it is, it's ancient. And they are overflying areas that have recently been seized, as you say, by the Chinese and armed by them with their most modern anti-aircraft and anti-ship missiles and fighter aircraft and so on. But back the lens up a little bit for us, Mark. Talk about what else the Chinese have been putting into place. As best we can tell, they're a secretive, deceptive Communist Party operation, let's face it. But what do we know about the nuclear buildup that the Chinese have been engaged in?
Well, as you say, China is extraordinarily secretive, and it's very difficult to get information about them. And they... as is indicated in a number of the Pentagon reports on China, they practice extensive concealment and deception activities. Having said that, they can't hide everything they're doing, and they have a very large-scale program involving multiple nuclear missiles. Others are nuclear-capable. Some of them are nuclear-only. They're expanding their capabilities. Everyone agrees on that. The size of the Chinese nuclear arsenal is subject to some dispute. Estimates range from a few hundred up to a few thousand. And my guess is that the low estimates are extremely low, and the real Chinese nuclear arsenal is several times that large at a minimum, and maybe even bigger than that.
And Mark, one of the uncertainties here, I guess, is that the Chinese are reportedly now putting intercontinental range ballistic missiles on mobile launchers inside a 3,000-mile underground tunnel complex they call the Underground Great Wall of China. If that were the case, it seems inconceivable, doesn't it, that there would be only 300 or maybe 400 nuclear weapons in that arsenal, especially when you add in submarines and bomber aircraft and the like as well?
Yes, I think this is basically Chinese disinformation. I've been saying for many years that the size of the underground Great Wall can't be justified in any way if they have only plans for a small strategic nuclear force. They wouldn't need one-tenth or even one-hundredth of that length of underground tunnels for that type of force. The size of this, in my view, is a very strong indication we're facing a major buildup, which will ultimately deploy possibly even thousands of strategic nuclear weapons on top of the tactical or theater nuclear capability. And that's a very disturbing development in light of the rather decrepit state of the U.S. nuclear deterrent capability.
Mark, I want to come back to that in some detail in our next block. We're going to have to pause here for just a moment. Dr. Mark Schneider, we will be right back with more on the Russian nuclear buildup and, yes, what we have in the way of a deterrent against such threats. That's with Dr. Mark Schneider of the National Institute for Public Policy, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back for a second segment with Dr. Mark Schneider, truly one of the most distinguished and respected analysts, monitors, and commentators upon what is going on in terms of nuclear warfare threats against America and specifically what the Chinese and most especially the Russians have been doing to intensify those threats. Dr. Schneider is these days with the National Institute for Public Policy, a second career after distinguished public service in the State Department and most especially the Defense Department for several decades. Mark, you have been warning for some time about what the Russians have been doing, some of it in violation of arms control commitments they've undertaken, some of it evidencing capabilities we've not seen before, some of it we may not fully understand exactly the kinds of capabilities that they are fielding. Give us, as best you can, briefly, a sense of the comprehensiveness and the magnitude of the investment Vladimir Putin's regime has been making in threatening us, let's be clear, a nuclear force capable of attacking this country, and for that matter, our allies, of course, as well, that we've never seen before, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, that's certainly true. We have a massive nuclear modernization program underway in Russia. It's essentially Soviet-like. Now, the numbers they're producing aren't nearly as great, but the diversity of the program is as great or greater than what we saw during the Soviet period. And while we had comprehensive modernization programs during the Soviet period, we don't have that today. Our programs are a tiny fraction of what is going on in Russia. They are very slow. We're not going to see significant modernization of U.S. forces until the late 2020s. Russia will not only have completely modernized its forces by the time that we get our first new system, online, but they will have modernized and then modernized the modernized systems in effect.
They will have lapped us, in other words, at least once. And Mark, we'll come back to the U.S. stuff in a minute, but just again, drill down on this. There has historically been three legs, as we call them, of the strategic triad of the Russians and before them the Soviet Union. They place more emphasis on ground-based missile systems than on the others. But you're describing important improvements in every area of those forces, plus some new capabilities. Talk, if you would, about both.
Well, it's no longer a triad on their part. It's more like five separate legs of their deterrent capability. In addition to at my count, at least 22 major strategic nuclear modernization programs.
Wait a minute. Say that again. 22 major strategic nuclear modernization programs?
Yes, and that's the minimum number, and it's probably greater than that. It's literally several different types of missiles for each leg of the deterrent, and now more than at least two to three types of bombers are being worked on. They may, by the way, one of the systems from when you were in the Defense Department, Assistant Secretary, the Backfire is being extensively modernized and given not only an intercontinental capability, but a much improved anti-carrier strike capability. In addition to the 22 systems, we see things like they're now calling it the Poseidon. It used to be called the Canyon or Status 6. It's a intercontinental range, ultra-high speed, ultra-deep diving drone submarine, which, according to the Russian press, including state media, carries a 100 megaton warhead and possibly even what's called the Cobalt bomb, which is an enhanced radiation weapon.
This is truly a doomsday device, is it not?
Yes, it can destroy entire cities. I mean, the blast effects go out 20 or 30 miles, and the radiation effects will go out several hundred miles in the direction the wind is blowing. There's no way to use this thing without genocidal effects. It's impossible to limit damage from it, and their ambassador to the United States just a day or two ago said that they won't limit this in any way. So this thing is going on first test of it was reported by Bill Gertz years ago. Putin just announced that it had been successfully tested. It's in the nuclear posture review. So this is absolutely real. There's no question.
And there are parts, some reports, Mark Schneider, that the so-called Belgorod submarines may have six of these aboard them. So, I mean, what we're talking about is truly, as you say, a genocidal systems that seem to be designed for precisely that purpose. And Mark, I want to make sure we've got some time to talk about our own capabilities, but just to wrap this up, in terms of those strategic forces, in addition, the Russians have been building and maintaining, of course, large numbers of so-called tactical nuclear weapons. What's the difference in a practical matter, as a practical matter, between those two categories? Is there one?
In some respects, they're very different. You have weapons very small, designed to be used on the battlefield. In other cases, you're talking about systems, very long-range cruise missiles and hypersonic weapons that are strategic in all but name. So these are very capable. They exist in the thousands. They are thoroughly modernizing them. This is in the Nuclear Posture Review and statements by senior U.S. Generals. So there's no question about this going on in a very extensive scale. I've actually written article on each of the legs of the Russian tactical nuclear capability and one on the low-yield nuclear capability, and they're available on the Internet.
These should be required reading from the National Institute for Public Policy?
One of them, yes. One of them is in the U.S. Naval Institute Proceedings. A couple of them, two or three of them, are in Real Clear Defense.
Okay. Well, if you will get us the links, Mark, we'll make them available to our listeners. And I appreciate so much your scholarship and your authority on these matters. Let me just very quickly turn to something you touched on earlier, Mark Schneider. Anybody listening to this litany of frightening developments in China and Russia, to say nothing of what the North Koreans or the Iranians may have up their sleeves, I think will appreciate that what we have long taken for granted in terms of our own deterrent capacity is becoming more important by the day. And yet, as you say, the modernization of our forces, long overdue as it is not going to happen anytime soon. And that's frankly under the best of circumstances. And unfortunately, we may not be facing the best of circumstances. The new chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Adam Smith of Washington State, has made it absolutely clear he intends to move us instead towards a minimal deterrent capability. Talk us through the obsolescence of our existing forces, Mark, and not just the forces themselves, but, you know, the entire weapons complex, really, and what that means in terms of the quality of our deterrent, even if Adam Smith doesn't have his way.
Even the existing program, which is basically the Obama administration program to sustain the triad plus a few useful changes to it. However, most of what we're doing is on a relatively modest development pace. The only thing we're doing rapidly is, and I think this is very important, is fielding the low-yield warhead on the Trident. This may very literally prevent a nuclear war.
But Adam Smith is saying he intends to stop that program, as I understand it.
Yeah, but there's such a thing as a veto, and I don't think he can't stop it. It's too cheap, and it's already in production. Setting that thing aside, the problem with the House, and it's a very, very serious problem. He has endorsed one of the most extreme forms of minimum deterrence that literally exists. He keeps talking about a publication by Bruce Blair, which is full of errors from one end to the other, and is just an extremist approach to nuclear deterrence.
This is kind of a piece with the sort of larger global nuclear disarmament program, Global Zero, I guess it's called, that has been kicking around for quite some time. But you now have somebody in a very senior position.
He's one of the main authors of the Global Zero report, and what this new one is nothing but a more extreme version of the Global Zero report, with all of the same distortions and inaccuracies of fact, which go to the very heart of the report in terms of our requirements.
And misguided recommendations too, needless to say. Mark, we have to leave it at that for the moment. There is so much more to talk about here with you, and I hope you'll indulge us by coming back again soon. Next up, we'll talk with Robert Spencer, one of the country's other leading experts, in his case, about Sharia supremacism and the jihad that is trying to impose it upon all of us. That and more right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it is a delight to say we are joined by one of the most courageous, articulate, knowledgeable, thoughtful men I know, most especially when it comes to his chosen area of expertise, which is, well, I call it Sharia, the driving force behind authoritative Islam that all faithful Muslims, the authorities of that faith say, are obliged to try not only to practice themselves, but impose on everyone else through jihad of various forms. Robert Spencer is, of course, known perhaps best for his 15, count them, 15 books, many of them New York Times bestsellers, including The Truth About Muhammad, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Crusades, and The Complete Infidel's Guide to Iran. His most recent book, he's actually said he thinks his most important, is The History of Jihad from Muhammad to ISIS. He's also the director of a marvelous website, Jihad Watch, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He's a good friend and a most admired colleague and always a welcome guest here. Robert Spencer, thank you for joining us, and thank you for giving us two segments of your time today to talk about a very important issue at the moment. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. It's always good to talk to you.
Thank you. Robert, I want to visit with you about the opening that our mutual friend, Judge Jeanine Pirro, had on her program last week, in which, with characteristic panache, she took on, and one might say took down, Representative Ilhan Omar, a Somali-American expatriate, now a sitting member of the United States Congress, over her overt anti-Semitism and failure to either apologize seriously and authentically for such behavior, or to be properly held accountable for it by her colleagues in the House of Representatives. Specifically, Jeanine Pirro made an interrogatory of Ilhan Omar, and I wanted just to walk through with you what she said, because it has brought down on the judge not only the unbridled wrath of Omar and her Muslim Brotherhood friends and other Sharia supremacists, but Fox News itself. Can you walk us through what prompted this controversy and where the truth lies?
Absolutely, Frank. Jeanine Pirro said exactly this. Think about this. She, that is Ilhan Omar, she's not getting this anti-Israel sentiment doctrine from the Democrat Party. So if it's not rooted in the party, where is she getting it from? Think about it. Omar wears a hijab, which, according to the Quran 33:59, tells women to cover so they won't get molested. Is her adherence to this Islamic doctrine indicative of her adherence to Sharia law, which in itself is antithetical to the U.S. Constitution? That's what she said. There is absolutely nothing false about that. There are many women who wear headscarves in all kinds of cultural contexts, but there's no doubt that there are many Muslim women who wear hijab as is an indication of their adherence to Sharia. And there is also no doubt that Sharia is antithetical to the U.S. Constitution. It denies the freedom of speech, the freedom of conscience, the equality of rights of women, the equality of rights of non-Muslims. It is an authoritarian, supremacist, aggressive, expansionist, and violent doctrine. And so to ask, as Jeanine Pirro did, if Ilhan Omar is adherent to Sharia, as indicated by her wearing the hijab, is a perfectly legitimate question. And indeed, it's a question that we need to be asking and need to have this public discussion in the U.S. precisely because of the incompatibility of Sharia with constitutional principles and universally accepted ideas of human rights.
I strongly agree. Let me ask you, Robert Spencer, among the things that Sharia commands, of course, is that all of its adherents, and again, everyone else, conform to God's law, or Allah's law, as they say, namely Sharia, and not man-made laws. And I would just ask you, what role in a body like the United States Congress could someone who does adhere to Sharia, and let's just say for the purpose of discussion, that person might be Representative Omar. What role could she possibly see herself playing in making laws, which is, after all, the job of a United States congressman or woman, if that seems so fundamentally at odds with what are the central tenets of Sharia?
Well, the only thing that a Sharia adherent Muslim who is aware of the contents and the nature of Sharia would be doing in the U.S. Congress would be trying to make the U.S. more Sharia compliant. And so Representative Omar, if she is Sharia adherent, is very likely to support measures that would restrict the freedom of speech, particularly when it comes to criticism of Islam. And that's not fantasy. Remember that Tom Perez, the leader of the Democratic National Committee, when he was in the
Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department.
Thank you, yes. And he refused to deny that there would be restrictions on the freedom of speech and particularly on criticism of Islam coming from the Obama administration. Now, this is a long-standing effort. Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, spoke to the OIC, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, and said that spoke about ways to circumvent the First Amendment and use peer pressure and shaming to get people to stop criticizing Islam. So the idea that Ilhan Omar would do this in the Congress is not at all far-fetched and would be in line with Sharia blasphemy restrictions. There are other things, of course, as well. It's not likely that she's going to support women's rights initiatives or other things that are at variance with Sharia principle.
Let me ask you, as a serious student of these matters, Robert Spencer, to address a concern that I have about the response to what Ilhan Omar has been doing, has been to date, and how that is perceived by, again, her and others like her. Starting with the very first act, I believe, of the United States House of Representatives in the 116th Congress, which was to change the rules of the House with respect to whether any kind of headgear could be worn by members on the floor of the House, something that had never been permissible up to this point. First order of business, allow, in this instance, Ilhan Omar to wear her hijab on the floor of the House. Then, of course, the controversy that has consumed a lot of attention in recent weeks, which is how the House of Representatives, specifically the Democratic Caucus, was going to deal with her rabidly anti-Semitic statements and ultimately came up with a resolution that was, I think it's fair to say, inadequate in a number of respects with respect to her, you know, challenging her or holding her to account or otherwise censoring her for those kinds of comments. And more to the point, she took a victory lap after it because it actually mentioned on a par with anti-Semitism, this business about Islamophobia, of which both you and I have been accused. Talk us through that, Robert. Is the likelihood that the Sharia-adherent Muslims, both in the United States House of Representatives, as best I can tell, there are three of them, in addition to Omar, Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, and Andre Carson, who hails from Indiana, are they likely emboldened by what has been done here? However we dress it up as political correctness or whatever, it's seen by them, I fear, as submission. And that doesn't work well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, Ilhan Omar completely won, defeated all of her opponents. The Democratic Party was set to unmistakably condemn her. They didn't quite have the courage to name her in the original resolution, but it was unmistakable who it was about and what it was about. It was all about her and her anti-Semitism. And by the time the dust cleared and everything was finished, it was very clear that they did not have the courage to rebuke her in any way or to make any kind of statement saying that what she was standing for was wrong. And so what we have is the normalization and the mainstreaming of this anti-Semitism, and moreover also this Sharia adherence. And there is no way that there can be anything positive coming from that. It's only going to result in more introduction of Sharia principles into the U.S., and that will mean ultimately more strife.
Hmm. More accommodations begets more demands for accommodations when one deals with, you know, these Sharia supremacists. One of the other pieces, you've written very thoughtfully about this over the years, Robert. I think you, in fact, coined the term stealth jihad to describe what this organization, the Muslim Brotherhood, with which Ilhan Omar consorts, as does Rashida Tlaib, as does Andre Carson, by the way. These are people who are, I think, highly sensitized to the need for the moment to engage in sort of the stealthy kind of jihad rather than look towards what Sharia ultimately calls for, which is the violent kind. But these Muslim brothers are very attuned to shifts in power. And we have to pause for just a moment, Robert Spencer. When we come back, I want to ask you the pregnant question here. Do accommodations, do acts of submission, as they see them, actually trigger in people like the Brotherhood and, again, other Sharia supremacists, the sense that they may actually be able to go from the stealthy kind of civilization jihad over to the preferred kind, according to Muhammad, the violent kind? We'll talk with that and Robert Spencer about much more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back with the author of, among many other important books concerning one of the great challenges of our time, Sharia supremacism, the history of jihad from Muhammad to ISIS. His name is Robert Spencer, the director of Jihad Watch. You can find it at jihadwatch.org. He is an extraordinary resource, both as a speaker, as a writer, and not least as, of course, an author of these indispensable books. Robert, we were talking before the break about the nature of civilization jihad, or stealthy jihad, as you've called it, that operates in an environment where Muslims are not strong enough to follow Muhammad's perfect example into the violent kind of jihad. And I always worry about that tipping point when they think that they are now strong enough to do that, to make that changeover. That's the trajectory. We're seeing it elsewhere around the world, of course, even to some extent in places like Europe. But when they make those calibrations. It seems to me it's in no small measure informed by what they sense is the will of their opponents, the kufrs, if you will, the infidels, to resist. Submission, in other words, to them is a leading indicator of what they can get away with. Am I, you know, mistaken in that assessment?
No, you're absolutely right. The thing is that the objective of both stealth jihad and violent jihad is ultimately to impose Sharia, which denies the equality of rights of the kuffar, the non-Muslim, and it creates a society in which discrimination against non-Muslims and women is institutionalized. So whenever the opportunity to advance this agenda is presented in whatever way, then if somebody has his or her eyes on the goal, then they're going to take advantage of that. And this is what we're seeing. The weakness of the Democrats and the unwillingness of the left to criticize anything regarding Islam in any slightest degree is only emboldening those who want ultimately to subvert the entire constitutional order and impose Sharia. They may never be able to attain that goal in the United States, but they can certainly wreak a lot of havoc in attempting to do so.
They certainly can, and there's a lot of reason to believe they will, if permitted to do so. Robert, you have written copiously on these matters. We've published a fair amount at the Center for Security Policy as well, and you can find ours at securefreedom.org, available as free downloads, by the way. But I won't suggest that they're comparable in terms of quality to your own. But one that I have been particularly impressed as a early warning of what is to come is a book by several of my colleagues about what we call it Star Spangled Sharia. And it's about this group called the U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations, which is the franchise in this country of a global organization, the Council of Muslim Organizations. And it has set as its particular purpose, it's a Muslim Brotherhood front, I think it's fair to say, the election of Sharia-adherent Muslims. And again, the issue here, folks, is not that they're Muslim. It's that they embrace this totalitarian ideology, that they are, by adhering to it, obliged to try to foist on us one way or the other, by stealth, by violence, coercive means, what have you. And Robert, I just wonder, we've reportedly had some 90 Muslims, I think, of this character, backed by Muslim Brotherhood front organizations, including the USCMO, run for office across the United States in the past election cycle at different levels, most of them not federal. We've had three elected to Congress, as I mentioned. We had one who was previously in Congress, Keith Ellison, elected to be the top law enforcement officer of the state of Minnesota. If it is the case, as Keith Ellison, formerly the number two at the DNC under Tom Perez, the Democratic National Committee, had it, you know, they want to double the number of their types of Muslims in Congress and elsewhere every cycle. What would you expect to see as their numbers increase, as their seeming importance in the political calculations of especially the Democratic Party grows accordingly?
Well, what you're going to see is just more of what we saw in the last couple of weeks with Ilhan Omar, that there will be increasingly open, strident, unapologetic statements of various Sharia principles, of denial of various aspects of American law that contradict Sharia, and of course, more anti-Semitism and such. And this will be accompanied by an increasing weakness on the part of those who have aided and abetted all this to happen in the first place to stop it and to rebuke it in any way. So we're just going to see more aggression, more assertiveness, and more throwing their weight around on the part of those who are Sharia adherent. They have been emboldened. They see that nothing really is arrayed against them. No one can stop them. Those who dare to raise any kind of contradictory voice are demonized and smeared, as you have noted, as Islamophobic. And so there are no obstacles in their way, and they will continue to press on in order ultimately to gain full power.
Yeah. And that's the predictable trajectory of this thing. And if one doubts that this could possibly happen here, again, I commend everybody to just look at what's going on in Europe, where in country after country after country, large numbers of Muslims, not all, but enough, who embrace this Sharia doctrine are voting blocks that are becoming influential, if not determinative, of who controls power in parliamentary systems, and are therefore being accommodated and are being emboldened and are becoming, as you say, Robert Spencer, more and more and more aggressive. And not necessarily in a violent way just yet, but that is coming, I'm quite certain. Robert, you spoke of this determination of Ilhan Omar and people like her to silence critics and to find ways of doing it in the past with the help of the Obama administration. Hillary Clinton famously saying they would use old-fashioned techniques of shaming and peer pressure, effectively, to suppress what they abhor, I think she put it, in the way of factual commentary, like the kind you provide and we try to provide on what Sharia entails and its dangers. When you look at the sort of team that is trying to suppress the likes of thee and me, and many, many others, one that stands out is the Southern Poverty Law Center. Not, to the best of my knowledge, a Muslim Brotherhood front, and yet one that seems to be very closely aligned with these Sharia supremacists and enormously helpful to their efforts to impose effectively Sharia blasphemy laws on us. You've had some hard experience with the SPLC, as have I. Talk a little bit about this organization, what it does, and why it would be putting itself in the service of efforts to suppress the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, free speech.
Among the left worldwide, and particularly in the West, is this notion that the real problem is American imperialism and Israel and so on, and that Islamic terror attacks are just a response to all that. So it's really our fault. And Muslims are victims. They are victims of racism, of white supremacism, and so on. And the SPLC certainly adheres to this view and never seems to notice jihad groups or Islamic hate groups in the United States, but is determined to demonize and defame and thereby destroy, and this is something they've said explicitly, groups such as the Center for Security Policy and the David Horowitz Freedom Center and others that are dedicated to trying to resist this oppressive and violent ideology.
Robert, we are out of time, I'm sorry to say. I'd love to have you come back for a full hour to address these and so many other issues that you cover brilliantly at Jihad Watch. Thank you for your time today, though, and for your courage in standing up against these efforts to suppress our freedom of speech, and most especially to preclude the American people from understanding the real dangers that we're facing now from Sharia supremacists. Robert, come back to us again very soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.